Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Whitehaven Coal half-year results presentation. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session for analysts only, at which time, if you wish to ask a question, you'll need to press 0 followed by 1 on your telephone. Any media questions should be directed to the company. Please note that this conference is Friday, 16th of February, 2018. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Mr. CEO and Managing Director. Thank you very much, sir. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for taking the time to dial in to Whitehaven Coal's half-year results for financial year 18. As in the past, I'll quickly go through our presentation and then open up the lines for question and answer. I was aware just a little bit of static on the line as we opened it up, so I'll continue with the presentation unless I'm told to adjust in some way. I'm over on our highlights page just for the half year, and then for us it's been a record half year profit, as you would have predicted based on the operational results that we put out now a month ago. And just going through quickly some of the highlights there. Our safety momentum, as you heard back at the quarterly report, has certainly continued, and as a result, our TRIFR result at 6.19 has been the lowest the company has recorded at that time. I'm pleased to announce that that momentum is continuing into this new calendar year, and so we look to continue that safety improvement as we continue to produce more coal. Of course, being the financial results, the half-year results for net profit on net profit terms has been a very good result, $257 million at the NPAT level, 63% over the previous corresponding period. The equity coal sales, as I mentioned a month ago now, 9.2 million tonnes, does include the purchase coal during the period. And our EBITDA numbers at $460 million for the half-year, 42% up period on period. As a result of that cash flow, our gearing levels have dropped substantially. And as a result, the board's been able to confirm that we will be declaring an interim dividend of 13 cents per share. Just over on safety, I'm over on page 5. Clearly, every mining company seeks to balance the production, increase production with improved safety. In fact, I'm sure if you speak to any mining company, they'll tell you that one is not achievable without the other. And certainly since we've implemented our Safe Haven Rules program, we've certainly seen an improvement in our safety, and we look to continue to improve that over time. We have many sites going multiple financial years now without any incidents, and we seek to replicate that across the balance of the group. So we're not giving up on this, and there's a lot more work to do, but it's pleasing to see the momentum continue as we drive our performance to greater heights in that regard. Now, the financial results, as you would have seen this morning, first half of the year versus the previous corresponding first half of the year, some $100 million up at an NPAT level, $257 million is certainly a tremendous result, 63% up. EBITDA, as I mentioned, $460 versus $324, 42% up. Cash generated from operations certainly showing the benefit of improved pricing, up 55%, $409 versus $263. And our costs in particular, when we look at that, we are on track for our guidance at $60 is what we mentioned, and our belief is that we'll be able to hold that through the balance of this financial year as well. Net debt at $146 as at 31st of December, really was a product of having paid our final dividend, and as we speak to you today, we're broadly net debt neutral at the moment, in fact. So gearing very light as at 31st of December, but since that time, obviously, we've zeroed out even that debt as well. The profit results, as you can see, a little bit more detail broken up to each of the categories across on page 8. Revenues obviously had a step up with that improved pricing during the period at $1.15 billion versus $950, so a good result. And that obviously cascades through into the operating cash flow, EBITDA, and obviously the non-cash charges below there, and driving down to a net profit of $257, as we mentioned. Period on period, obviously, we don't have any significance in this half, so that's a clean set of results at that $257 257 level. The benefit obviously been holding our costs in under control, even despite the fact that the industry is experiencing some cost inflation is trickling down to the bottom line. And as you can see here, the average price per tonne that we've been achieving net of royalties is flowing down to the bottom line as well. So our EBITDA margins have improved over the period, which is pleasing to see. Balance sheet is in good shape, as you would imagine, given the cash flow generation that's been occurring and the delevering over the last 18 months that's occurred. Cash, as you know, generally $100 million in the bank. Our secured facilities, you can see, they're drawn at 190, but as I say, as we stand here today, largely done. And net debt at that period, $147 million in total, but I say now we're largely debt-free. I'm over on the operations at page 12. These numbers you've seen before, so I won't belabor them too much, obviously a month ago with our quarterly report. But as a group, doing reasonably well. Record sales, as you can see, they're at 9.2, inclusive of some purchased coal, compared to the previous corresponding period on the same basis of 7.8. Sales are going well. Sales have been very solid during the course of this period, in fact, and you can see with the two pie charts there, a different story in terms of the thermal coal, quite concentrated around Japan, Korea, Taiwan, whereas the met coal sales, you can see there's quite a diverse spread of markets that we're being able to open up now, which was certainly positive for the future. Managed coal sales at nearly 12 million tonnes, 16% of the previous corresponding period, and our spread of met coal, as I say, is starting to show a more even and balanced structure across our customer base. It will be interesting to see how that goes for the second half of this financial year. Over at Maules Creek, production's been very, sorry, I'm over on page 14, leading with Maules Creek, 3.8 versus 3.2 for a period-on-period comparison. Narrabri, as you know, has been a little bit disappointing by our standards at 2.7 versus 2.95 in the previous corresponding period. And as we discussed at the time of the quarterly report, obviously with secondary support requirements now being more evident than what they were in the past, we have diverted labour across to that exercise in order to make sure that we get that secondary support in whilst continuing to produce, although that manning, the tightness of manning has meant that we have taken a step back in production temporarily. Maules, as you would have heard back when we did the quarterly report, it's been going well, and I suppose the key takeaway for Maules for the second half is that we are aiming to achieve 11 million tonnes of ROM for this financial year, which is up on where we were guiding previously, and certainly we're on track to do that. Met coal sales have been subdued, there's no doubt. We've discussed that at length before, 19% of total sales. Our estimates for the full year in terms of met coal sales being between that 20 to 25% range. Narrabri, despite those bumps, is still one of the most productive longwall mines in the country, and certainly in this year had its third best half that we've recorded thus far. The guidance at 6 to 6.5, we're happy with that given where we've got to. But overall, this mine is performing well, and we continue to enjoy the low-cost profile that it adds to our portfolio blend of costs. The real announcement, I suppose, in the quarterly report was the decision that we've made to drive through the fault area that's both in that continues through longwall panel 8 and longwall panel 9. This was off the back of a very successful process to traverse the fault as it presents itself in longwall panel 7. That certainly has given us the confidence to move through that without those step arounds that we previously guided. And as a result, we've revised the FY19 and FY20 production guidance from 7.7 and 7 respectively, just reminding you that the 7 includes two changeouts in the FY20 period. Gunnedah operations continue to track well. Gunnedah obviously has a second half that's bigger than the first, and you can see that mapped out half on half there in this graph. We certainly expect the similar sort of split in production as we probably saw in the H2 of FY16. So going well. As you know, we've agreed with Idemitsu to purchase the 30% of Tauranga that we don't own, and we expect that that will complete during the balance of this financial year. The only remaining condition that needs to be met there is just a ministerial approval of that transfer of the tenement to ourselves. Very positive, that is. Vickery continues on the preparation work for the lodgement of the EIS, and we're certainly looking to lodge that in this quarter. All the associated work with the assessments of water, air quality, flood management, flora and fauna are largely complete, and it's really just the writing up of the documentation now, which will take place during the balance of this quarter for an end of quarter lodgement. We did, over the last quarter of last year, last calendar year, remove the Blue Vale pit out of what will be the enlarged EIS submission, and certainly the community's feedback on that has been very positive. Jumping over to community, we've had a very strong half year again. Looking back, we've got about 1,400 people in our workforce, about 75% of them live locally. We opened the sites up across the group and welcomed over 1,000 people to our various sites during the course of the last 6 months, which has been a tremendous experience for a lot of people to come and see what it is we're doing, and the feedback from those open days has been very positive. We see that as being an important limit in our engagement strategy with the community, and we'll keep that up in years to come. There's 40 organisations that which enjoyed support from us during the course of this last half year, and we see that being spread between a diverse areas of education, health, training and tertiary education, and it's a broad-based level of support that I think the community expects from us, and that certainly we're happy to contribute over time. If we look at the amount of money spent in the area since 2012, that sums up over $1 billion now, so certainly we are a major contributor in the area. And of course, we do take polling during every year in the community, and certainly the feedback from the community in terms of their perception of us and their interaction with us in the region has been very positive and trending ever more favourably during the course of our activities. I'm over on the outlook for coal. I think it's worth noting that just with what's becoming ever clearer with the publication of individual countries' NDCs as part of COP21, we now see that there are 24 countries which represent over half the CO2 emissions of the world have included coal as part of their answer to the challenge of reducing emissions globally. So we're seeing a lot of that actually focused in our area with some of the major users, China, India and Japan, certainly forecasting that they're going to be using coal for a long time to come. And of course, there are areas of growth in Southeast Asia which are obviously underpinning the incremental growth that we're seeing going forward. Obviously, Australia is strategically located to these markets, and we see that as a major opportunity for Australia. Obviously, the engine, the driver of all this is the Asian region, and whilst there are various scenarios in terms of where China goes over time, it's very clear that overall the Asian region is the epicentre of thermal coal demand over the outlook period for the IEA's numbers. Now, this period extends from 2016 through to the 2040 period, which sees substantial growth in total coal consumption during that period from just under 4 billion tonnes through to 4.44 billion tonnes of coal equivalent during that same period. That's a substantial increase, nearly 560 million tonnes per annum. And the reason for that, obviously, is electricity growth in Southeast Asia in particular. So if we look over that same forecast period, it's forecast to grow by 578 terawatts of power. That's 180% increase of electricity generated from coal during that period. So the overall proportion of coal share of electricity generation goes from 35% in 2016 up to 40% in 2040. Over that same outlook period, obviously renewable generation increases also and increases substantially off a very low base, but even at 2040 that continues to be a very low level of penetration after what the IEA estimates to be several trillions of dollars invested in renewables over that period, only to result in 6% penetration in 2040. I think that that gives some context to the comments that were made this week from the head of the IEA which acknowledges the critical role that CCS needs to play in achieving the global emissions reduction aspirations, given that obviously 6% in 2040, after several trillions of dollars have been spent, is not going to deliver the emissions reduction aspirations that the world has. Hence, he is citing the critical part that CCS must play over that same time horizon. So why is coal so widely used across Asia? As we know, it's very competitive from a cost perspective. And as you can see here, coal with ultra-supercritical technology in US dollar terms is obviously very favourable compared to pretty much any other form of electricity generation you care to imagine. And if the very necessary equation that we're seeing play out in Australia, as it does play out around the world, intermittent renewables need to be firmed up, and when you add that firming capacity, be that with batteries or gas or coal, the cost of renewables once firmed makes them even less competitive than what this graph will depict. So that's certainly the reason for that growth. As that generation has been rolled out and as that proportion of electricity is produced from coal, countries are increasingly turning to heli technology to take up the challenge here and reduce emissions over what's seen as higher emissions subcritical technology deployed in the past. Subcritical does obviously continue for a period, but if you look at it, the growth over that period, the incremental growth comes from heli technology. So in terms of the outlook for Whitehaven, looking at the world thermal coal demand, I think if we look at a smaller time horizon, just to look at our immediate future, and using crude numbers here, the expectation is that coal is going to grow by 400 million tonnes over 5 years to that 6.3 billion tonnes 2017 to 6.7 billion tonnes in 2022. So quite a substantial increase. It obviously is centred in our backyard, and as we know, supply-side response to fuel that incremental demand is quite muted at the moment. I think that's quite a challenge for our industry as a whole to make sure that we've got a regulatory framework that allows us to capture some of the benefit of this expected demand by being able to bring on new projects in a responsible manner. That same demand in our key markets is obviously growing substantially as well. So if we look at Whitehaven's key markets, a forecast to grow from 567 million tonnes to 628 million tonnes over that same period, just under 11% growth in that 5 years, as I say. That's quite a short period of time, and the supply-side response from Australia during that period of time, I think, will be muted, which bodes well for prices over that same outlook period. Whitehaven's production profile in the more immediate term as a company, we've mapped that out in terms of what we've done in the past more recently, but also extended out the forecast for you in terms of individual increments from both our Narrabri and Maules Creek mine playing out in 2019. And then we've introduced Vickery's tonnes as they start to emerge during the construction phase of Vickery and then also ramping up. 2024, we'll see the full ramp up of Vickery's tonnes, leading us just under 35 million tonnes per annum on a managed basis. Well, look, targets for the balance of our 2018 year, we obviously want to continue to focus on our safety. We think we can do more, and I look forward to reporting on that when we get to the financial year close. Saleable coal production guidance of 20.5 to 21, we're on track to deliver that. Cost guidance, as I mentioned earlier, at $60 per tonne Aussie, we're confident we can deliver that in this year. Maules Creek, as we said, we want to ramp that up to 11 million tonnes. That's an extra 500,000 over where we previously guided at the beginning of this financial year. We have kicked off an evaluation project for the autonomous fleet at Maules Creek, so we certainly look to that to progress during the balance of this financial year. That's a multi-year exercise, but it's very pleasing to see that kicked off now on site, a very exciting prospect for Maules Creek. Maules Creek semi-soft penetration obviously continuing to push that hard, and now that we see the spread between the thermal inclusive of our premiums versus the spot semi-soft market widening out, it certainly puts more dollars into that equation for us, and of course lodging the EIS for Vickery at the end of this quarter. From a financial perspective, we'll return surplus cash to shareholders. I know we've said that in the past, but that certainly will be the modus operandi for the company going forward in the absence of anything meaningful to deploy capital to. We'll maintain that strong balance sheet, and critical to that obviously is keeping a control on costs during a period of some tightness in the industry for labour in particular. So with that, I'll close the formal part of the presentation. It's been a very good 6 months. We look forward to building on that for the second half of the year. And with the outlook for supply demand, we don't see any reason why we shouldn't be also delivering a solid set of results in that second half as well. So with that, I'll hand back to the operator, and we'll get some question and answers going.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to queue for a question, please press 0 followed by 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press 0 then 2. Once again, that is 0 followed by 1 on your telephone. Our first question comes from the line of Clark Wilkins from Citi. Your line is open. Please ask your question.
Good morning, Paul. Just a couple of quick ones. The Tarawonga stake, has that been disclosed in terms of how much payment or how much, what sort of cash flow impact can we expect in June half if that does close? And also, can you just remind us about the exposure to the Japanese fiscal year contracts and with that sort of settlement outstanding, what sort of potential leverage there is if depending on where those prices settle?
Yeah, thanks, Clark. Two questions there. Tarawonga, we haven't disclosed the financial aspects of that arrangement. There's some confidentiality that binds us to do that. But I can tell you that it's not material, in the context of the half-year results, let alone full-year results. So it'll be accretive. There's another 600,000 tonnes per annum that obviously you'll see us report in the new financial year in terms of our own equity production, but it's certainly accretive from the get-go. It was a good deal. Nice to have done, and as I say, ministerial approval is the remaining piece of that puzzle, and that'll come in due course. In terms of Japanese exposure, look, you can see that there's a high proportion of our overall tonnes being sold into Japan, but only a subset of those are exposed to that contractual settlement that you're referring to. The exact split of that, and I've got, as usual, Jamie, Kevin and Ian here, I don't have to hand in terms of that exact split of the JFY contract tonne, so I'll have to come back to you on that, but we do have that number here. But it's, I would have said, overall, it's not great. It's between 5 and 10%. So obviously we've been the beneficiary of the GC Nuke exposure in more recent times, but I think it's about no more than 10% of our coal, our Japanese thermal coal, is exposed to that settlement.
Is there a target to increase that, providing more sort of security around prices for the year, or is it you're quite happy to sort of keep the exposure at those sort of levels?
Yeah, look, Clark, it's an interesting dynamic, and not one I have to say that we hold a lot of the negotiating power in. And in the past, more recent times, you would not be encouraging us to do that, given where the divergence between us and prices has been in that regard. So anyone who's been on some of those previous settlements over the last couple of years haven't actually done terribly well out of that. And so there are swings and roundabouts in it. Customer demand generally, they are trying to move to a more spot basis, if I can call it that. Obviously, GC Nuke is the primary index that we use in settling coal into Japan, and there are various arguments for and against that. But as a general principle, I'd have to say that I see more Japanese customers wanting to use that than I am seeing encouragement to go to the annual Japanese financial year settlement.
Yeah. Great, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Your next question comes from the line of Duncan Simmons from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead, sir.
Oh, good morning, guys, and congratulations on the results. So just a couple of questions. Narrabri, I know there's been a few hiccups there, but I guess the key question that I've got is, when do you think when do you think you'll get a good sense of whether the face widening project was actually worth it? I know that you spent, just under $100 million on that. So when should we be expecting that to come through? That's the first one. And the second one relating to Narrabri is that aware that you've got that preemptive on a transaction which went through with EDF selling their stake. Is there any update on how that's progressing? And that's it. Thanks.
Yep. Okay. Thanks, Duncan. I'll make a couple of comments. I'm sure Jamie would want to chime in here as well. Look, as far as the face widening project at Narrabri, we're absolutely convinced that that was well worth it. Certainly not. The individual bumpiness that we've experienced more recently with the desire or the need to put more secondary support in the roof is actually unrelated to that. So our aspirations for the site and the benefit of going to 400 metre face remains robust as it was when we looked at this now or nearly 2 years ago. So absolutely convinced that that's the right answer for the mine. Obviously, the development meterage that obviously we save in going to the 400 metre face is great. The productivity gains we've already seen in this panel certainly indicates and reinforces the assumptions that we made as to what we should see in terms of step up in productivity per hour and per day and per month with the mine has been very reassuring that the assumptions we used were right. As I say, the secondary support, the advent of the need for secondary support earlier in the life of mine is what it is. We just need to acknowledge that. But once supported with a pattern that we're satisfied with, the productive capacity of the longwall shouldn't be influenced by that. So, James, do you want to make any more comments?
Yeah, look, only to echo your comments, Paul. I mean, in some ways, I guess the events that we've been experiencing since the commencement of Longwall 107 are masking, you know, the obvious benefits the widening to 400 metres delivers, you know, and certainly when the machine is performing well, the productivity, I guess, through that additional 100 metres of face width, you know, delivers an overall step up in productivity and the additional tonnes that we forecast on an annual basis will be delivered when we are in a situation with the secondary support that we've the incremental additional the secondary support that we've had to put in place has been put in place. But you know, the largest obvious benefit is that over the life of the mine there's 60 kilometres less of development roadways to be produced. You know, that starts from day one and continues through the life of the mine. So there's no doubt that the benefits of going 400 metres being delivered every day.
Yeah. And Duncan, that number that you mentioned was it was about 90 million, and that's at 100%, as opposed to our share.
For sure. 84 million, I think it was, 100%,
Yep. My number includes electrical upgrades that went with it as well, the 90.
Yeah.
So, preemptives. Yeah, look, the preemptive, that remains fluid. We've expressed our interest in it. Given that we are we're just one of a couple of parties, obviously, with our joint venture participants who also have similar rights to ourselves. These processes don't happen quickly. Having said that, I do think they're narrowing down to a timeline that now would likely see a conclusion of this this activity during this next 6 months. I think that's pretty safe to say now. But like I say, with the Japanese and Koreans and Chinese also involved in it, we all have different timelines for decision making, and we all have the same rights, obviously in different proportions, of course. But it it does involve multiple parties, we have expressed our strong interest in it, and we look for a conclusion of that over the next 6 months.
Okay, many thanks. Cheers.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Sam Webb from Credit Suisse. So please go ahead.
G'day guys, just three quick ones if I can. I was wondering if you could put a bit more commentary around your unit cost profile. So just a dollar a tonne rise half on half and you noted you'll keep costs flat going into the second half. So just trying to reconcile that with the guidance you gave at the quarterly for Narrabri cost to rise a couple of bucks a tonne. So just trying to have a think about that and maybe what we exit 18 and look like in 19 as Maules ramps up. And second one, wonder if you can put some colour around dividend and potential for further capital management. You know, to your comments, gearing's now effectively 0%. So with that in mind, How do you guys now think about what an appropriate level of net debt is or gearing at this time? And then just lastly, with regards to your comments around requiring additional port capacity over the next 5 years, just trying to understand what your current approvals are at the moment and when you expect to reach those limits and what the process is to increase that limit if you need to. Thanks.
Yep. Okay. All right, you've got a few questions there, Sam, so let me just write those down so I don't forget one or two of them. Look, the $2 per tonne, you know, is really, there's an amalgam of things working there. Some of that, the $2 longer term statement that we made was really for people to use for modelling going forward. In the short term, a lot of the work that we're doing, and this is cash that we are spending in that secondary support, actually gets deferred in the short term and then amortised over panels or roadways, depending on whether or not there are immediate gates that we're putting that in, or whether there's work in the mains, which are a life of mine, a mine asset. So it's the guidance we gave was really the long-term update that you should use for your modelling. In this more immediate period where we've seen, as you said, a change in our cost base, there's a couple of things at work there. Inflation, labour, as I mentioned, services, certainly people who've been on contracts with us and others, obviously, which have been a product of more challenging times for everybody. When they come up for renewal pool, people are looking for, you know, a little bit of an adjustment. And so that influences the cost base, as does, importantly, the mix in coal that we're selling. And as we've noted, we've got a little bit less Narrabri than what we'd like. The weighted average impact of that does drive, you know, our overall cost that we report at $60. Having said all that, we think we can hold $60 through the second half, you know, even with all those things at play. So we think that's a solid position to be in. Capital management, you know, this is really an important question for us all, and the board obviously turned their mind to that. The board's very pleased to be able to announce the 13 cents, and you know, that's a solid result, 50% of the NPAT, which is a good result. If we look at the cash flow over the last period, it's higher than that, as we paid out not just this one, but the 200 previous to that as well. I think really all I can say is just watch this space. Our capacity, or our guidance in the past, has been sort of 25 to 50 since we returned to dividend paying status, but we've observed that doesn't restrict in any way the capacity of the board to decide to do something else on top of that, in the absence of any other particular projects that we want to deploy capital to. And that's what we said. In the absence of a use for that capital that adds value to the business, we'll be sending money back to shareholders. And that'll be the approach that you'll see us use as the board refines this. In terms of what particular initiatives that the board determines appropriate to deliver that return, I think that'll play out over the next 6 months, be that in continued dividends or other instruments or buybacks and so on.
Port capacity.
Port capacity is an interesting one. Look, we've been the beneficiary of obviously ramping up production at a time when nobody else is doing that. And at that same time, most of those people having been long port capacity. So we've been the beneficiary of that, being able to take up that capacity as and when we've required it. And so we're just evaluating the strategic position with Vickery on the horizon as to when we need to be putting some longer-term contractual positions in place versus having enjoyed the benefit of the flexibility of being able to take spot capacity as and when. That applies not just to port, but it applies also to above and below rail as well. So as we draw closer to the development of Vickery, we will take a few decisions around those contractual positions that will see us lock in a little bit more. I'd have to say, as a general statement, we'd probably continue to be short, if I can call it that, even though we will contract a little bit more over time and continue to enjoy that flexibility of being able to take spot capacity at both port and rail. So I think you'll see us continue in that position over time. We used to publish a graph which showed our production profile relative to our take-or-pay commitments. Maybe over time we might bring that back so you can see that. But the general thesis will be stay a little short because there's plenty available to take from the market as and when you need it.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Peter O'Connor from Shaw and Partners. So please go ahead, sir.
Morning, Paul. Three questions. First is to follow on from the issue about preemptives. Are they sequential preemptives or preferential, or do all parties review at the same time? And is it a one-month, three-month period to review? So can you give a sense of a timeline? I know you gave us a broad timeline, but just wondering how that plays out.
Are you going to list the other ones, Peter, or are you?
Oh, yep. Semisoft, Maules Creek. Yep. Just listening to what you said in the commentary and the second half guidance from Maules Creek, it would appear that you'd be adding maybe 200, maybe 500,000 tonnes of semisoft to the market in the second half. How do you plan to do that? Going back to the comments you made on the quarterly call about how you saw the market coming back in January. And as part of that, looking beyond the short term, next 6 months, but medium term, plans to lift the coal processing plant capacity to get to that 50-50 split. What are those plans? How much will they incur and when are they being done? And lastly, on the longwall, just back to that 400-metre issue. Jamie, on the face conveyor, the AFC, is it a power issue, a chain issue, an integration issue, an OEM issue? What's driving that? And just to confirm your comment about the 60K of drivage, is that based on the plans only to the north, or is it the long blocks to the south that haven't been approved yet, or are you still drilling? I'm just wondering, that's a big number and it's impressive. Does it get bigger?
All right, let me try and start. I think I actually got five in there.
There I had subparts for those three main topics.
I was splitting hairs there, mate, but yeah, that sounds like a meeting rather than an investor call. Anyway, look, preemptives, we don't disclose that. That's subject to confidentiality arrangements, but like I say, we all share the same rights.
Right.
And there are no differing periods in which anyone can exercise those. The only things that would change that would be the style of transaction. But the transaction structure is known, that's proposed. Obviously, this is just a remnant piece of a broader restructure that JERA and EDF have gone through, and this small part of the puzzle is just a remnant piece of that. It's important to us, although it's a small piece of the overall JERA deal. So over the 6 months, I'm sure we'll come to a landing on that, and we'll have more to say. But we all share the same rights, although we've got 70%, and the other people involved have got 7.5%. So that's where that stands. Semi-soft, yeah. Look, the extra tons that you quoted, that's about right in terms of the numbers in the second half. I did make the statement a month earlier about renewed interest in semi-soft during that period, and so we've actually already made some incremental sales as a result of that renewed interest. As I say, that widening out of the split between spot thermal and spot semi looks healthier, and obviously that's reflective of some demand. It wouldn't have changed if there wasn't some demand coming up for that. So we see that improving during the second half. Keen to make sure now that spread is wide enough to make it incrementally beneficial to us to do that, we'll continue to push. In terms of the plant, no need to change anything to the plant. I'm not quite sure where that comes from, but no need for us to do anything in relation to the plant to be able to deliver on,
50-50.
On that. That's no problem at all. And at times, you know, we can swing that one way or the other, but, yeah, no issues there. AFC?
I mean, the decision we made in terms of the choice of the AFC has been the absolute right decision. I mean, in terms of the ability for that AFC to pull away after waiting events, I mean, the previous machine, because of its control systems, would never have looked at what we've been able to do with the AFC in the recent waiting events. We've got lots of installed capacity, the ability to go to the limits in terms of, you know, multiples of the installed capacity. Yes, it's seen that ASC do things, as I say, the previous machine would never have done. And it's not a commentary about one supplier versus another, it's just the other one was much less power and different control systems. The 60 kilometres is just the approved Narrabri North. It doesn't include anything or any benefits we may get from the yet-to-be-approved, you know, southern exploration licence, so it's just the North Narrabri approved mine.
Great. Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Andrew Hodge from Macquarie. Your line is open. Please go ahead, sir.
Sorry, I think I cut out there for a second. question was on Maules Creek costs from the mining fleet. And so I was just hoping, I guess, following up from Sam's question, just trying to understand how we should think about Maules Creek's costs as you, I guess, get the additional fleet online. And then also on top of that, I guess, just trying to think more broadly about autonomous and what it would mean there. Second question is about the rail cost reduction. And I just wanted to check to see that it's just in line with the AITC's WACC decision and there's not anything else that I'm missing. And then the third thing was really just, I guess, from a broad perspective, should we be thinking about that the way that you kind of think about Semisoft going forward is just about, it's essentially just tied into steel as well. And so what you're kind of essentially implying is that steelmakers kind of still see things to be slightly worse, so they're prepared to go back to using Semisoft as opposed to hard coking coal.
Mm. Yep. Maules Creek costs, we haven't split those out in the past, and I don't think, the only thing we've said about Maules Creek's costs is that over the next couple of years, you know, as the mine's ramping up, the hauls get a little longer as we were seeking to get to the bottom of the pit so we can start in pit dumping, and that's just a management activity that we've got to control over that period.
There's some real benefit, I guess, we'll see in the short term, I guess, in that aspect, though. I guess as we speak, we're clearing the travelling stock route, so that opens up a multiple of things. I guess, you know, we'll get multiple entry points or access points now out to the emplacement area, so we can get rid of some of the congestion that we've seen over the last 12 months in terms of haulage out to the dumps. Plus, it'll be a nice short tip during the winter months, I guess, where we see some impact on the operations as we manage our sound power levels, I guess, on surrounding neighbours. But the other aspect you mentioned, the autonomous, it's a multi-year project. So in the first couple of years, you know, it'll be evaluation of that technology and, providing a site for Hitachi to make this product truly commercial. In terms of, you know, where to in the future, I think, you know, you need to take guidance from what we've seen primarily at Fortescue, you know, and we'll see the same things. I guess those trucks will deliver more hours per year and, in the order, I guess, of 15 to 20% improvement in terms of hours. So, you know, that drives a lot of things, I guess, in terms of numbers of trucks required and an overall, overall reduction in costs associated with that.
And the rail one?
So you want to repeat the question on ARTC?
Sure. I just wanted to – there's a comment in there about saying that rail costs have been reduced in line with a renegotiation with the ARTC, and I just wanted to check to see that that's just in line with the comment that they've made overall about the reduction in WACC and therefore reducing rail costs across the system.
That's correct. Nothing more at work there than that.
Okay.
Semisoft going forward.
Yep.
I don't, Andrew, I don't see it as perhaps as black and white as perhaps I've interpreted the question. To the extent that the spread widens out, yeah, I think there's no doubt that there's a little bit more semi-soft coming back into people's blends. That's positive. Although you have to say that at the hard coke prices that we're seeing, you know, clearly that's indicative of some pretty strong demand on that side as well. So I wouldn't say that I'm speaking on behalf of any steel company. You know, that would be foolish to try and do that. But at these prices, I still think that their steelmakers are still able to pass on, incremental costs of the hard coke as far as the steelmaking process goes onto their end customers. And like I'm saying, it's not the divergence. The spread between the thermal and the semi-soft price isn't where we'd like it to be, but what we're acknowledging is that it's improved, and there's incremental margin in it for us to be producing that semi-soft over and above where we were 6 months ago.
Okay, and I guess just from a last, if I can sneak a last question, is just from a strategic point of view, I mean, I guess they're just trying to think about how you trigger and just saying with Vickery, and whether or not then you instead say maybe we would look to other opportunities and how you kind of balance that on a sort of medium-term basis.
Is your question, sorry, Andrew, just whether or not Vickery
More just about how you'd balance thinking about saying going for Vickery as opposed to if you had an opportunity to like use the balance sheet to make an acquisition or essentially.
Look, I think our view on Vickery is that we're very committed to it. It's a great opportunity in our backyard, and it has strategic importance to us longer term in terms of optimising Tarrawonga in particular. The 30% we've acquired of Tarrawonga gives us more flexibility in that regard, and being next door, you know, very close proximity to what would be a rail loop at Vickery and processing capacity sufficient to deal with the Tarra tons as well. That's quite a significant improvement to Tarra that we see is very, very important. Longer term, I mean, you look around the industry, you say, well, who's got 500 million tonne type resource of high quality coal, be that premium thermal and very good semi-soft, that's in the ground that can come to market? There's not too many people can do that. So we think Vickery definitely comes to market. As to how that plays out with respect to other opportunities as they present themselves from time to time, you can only judge that on the merits of whatever turns up at that time. But as far as we're concerned, Vickery is part of our future, and the timeline we've outlined in our slide here reconfirmed again today as to how we would like to bring that online.
Okay, excellent. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, sir. We have a follow-up question from the line of Duncan Simmons from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead, sir.
Oh, hi. Can I just have one follow-up, please? I guess the key thing, there's a number of assets up for sale at the moment in Australia in coal. And I guess the key thing is, you know, without going into too much, is that what if you guys are interested in some of those, what value do you think you bring to the table where you could defray the goodwill that you would, I guess, need to pay in the current market today? Do you think is it your expertise in operations or what are the sort of things that you think you could really add value there? Cheers.
Yeah, Duncan, look, I think as part of, without diving into any particular details of whatever things that you're referring to, as a company, we think we add value across the entire spectrum of resource development, coal resource development. So we've proven that we can get projects approved in the past. We've proven that we can build things cheaply, and we've proven that we can operate efficiently. So when we do that, of course, when we add those three limbs to a particular opportunity, we create the most value. We see Vickery being an example of that. And having said that, when you're applying all three dimensions to your armoury to a particular opportunity, that implies a greenfields opportunity, which comes with more risk. So you need to temper that, obviously, versus other opportunities, which would be optimising and improving existing assets, as you say, in order to generate a return on the goodwill that you mentioned. So look, as a value proposition, those three limbs are strategic to us, and anything that we might look at from time to time is seen through that lens.
Okay. And just to follow up on that, Paul, is that we were talking about surplus capital coming back to shareholders. Do you think the balance sheet is something that you just really keep a foot on at the moment until those opportunities kind of come and play out in the market?
No, look, I don't think our current posture is relative to anything that you're suggesting there. No, I think the current posture is really just about gradually moving back into a dividend paying form. And and the board really hasn't taken any longer term positions on this yet. Of course, we can all see that the cash flow generation of the business is strong, and absent Vickery, which is still a little way off in terms of approval timelines and then construction commitments being made and cash outflow associated with that, clearly we can do that within the existing cash flow generation of the business at the current run rate. So I would say. You know, when we get to the end of the financial year, you'll see the board want to say more about cash management and capital management more generally as it relates to our future.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Cheers.
Thank you. We also have a follow-up question from the line of Peter O'Connor from Shaw and Partners. Please go ahead, sir. Hello, Peter. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Next question. Operator.
There are no further questions at this point, sir. Please continue. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks all for dialing in. Appreciate the interest. And look, if there are any further questions to follow up, you know where to find us. But look forward to seeing you individually over the next the course of visitations over the next few weeks. Thanks very much, operator.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect. Thank you.